Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Finney Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the listening comfort of the intelligence agents who just, well, they're the only listeners that get paid to listen, ladies and gentlemen. So you keep them entertained. It's like, hey, bro, how are you doing? You know, you're doing your frickin' job of surveilling everybody and being a bastard. I mean, you'll have to forgive me, ladies and gentlemen. I'm in a little bit of a excitable mood, I think. This morning I just published the first ALCP podcast. That's the Aotearoa Legalized Cannabis Party, or all caps for short. And essentially what the thing that's happening in New Zealand right now is people are looking to legalize cannabis, and the government and the corporations and the police and the judiciary and all of those people who could legalize it are pulling out all the stops to prevent it from being so. So we've just sort of being the media resistance on that front, as well as many others. Speaking of fronts, ladies and gentlemen, precious metals. Very, very important thing, especially in the days when you are living off of fiat currency, which you cannot eat. Because of the fact that things like this, precious metals, retain value. Unlike at the end of empire, when currency will continue to be devalued. Now, today we have David Morgan, a.k.a. the Silver Guru, who features heavily in the Four Horsemen documentary, which I have had the pleasure to watch. And as I was watching it, I was going, hey, I've interviewed him. Hey, I've interviewed them too. And them. And them. And yeah. And I was like, no wonder I've got such a doomsday feeling vibe about my thoughts these days. Almost everybody I talk to knows what's going on and isn't living in a bubble of illusion. You know? That's what's problematic about reality, isn't it, folks? Is that it doesn't give a shit what you think. It doesn't care how you feel. It is what it is. David Morgan, the Silver Guru, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show.
Vinny, it's always a pleasure. I love your sense of humor. It's always a very quick 2 hours. And I just want to add on to what you said. I mean, from Ayn Rand, you can deny reality, but you cannot deny the consequences of denying that reality.
It is true. And she used the word, I prefer to do it in her accent, you know, you can ignore reality, but you cannot ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. See, it's always better when it's done with a funny impression, isn't it? Anyway, speaking of which, what have you been up to recently, David? How's the world looking for you?
Well, about the same. I mean, you know, if you go back, and I'm not big on politics, but let's face it, they affect all of us, and you've got to be realistic about it. So you go back pre-Trump, which is, more than a year and a half, in November in Canada, prior to the election, or maybe October, I was asked by an interviewer there, what did I think if Trump got elected? And I said, it's a math problem, not a political problem. The debt situation worldwide, U.S. being part of that, is unmanageable, and there will be some kind of a reset at some point in time. So to me, it was like changing the captain on the Titanic. It means the ship is going down, but if Trump got elected, there'd probably be livelier music. He'd bring steerage up to first class. There'd be a big party. Everyone would feel good, make things great again, blah, 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 blah. I don't want to discount some of the very important things that Trump has done, and I'm pretty politically neutral. I try to just stay, out of it, but you can't, by my own thought process, I've been on more of the libertarian bent for years. I don't affiliate with either the Socialist D or the Socialist R party. I prefer almost an anarchist approach to government. In other words, we probably could do it better by the people, for the people, and of the people, with very few, if any, bureaucrats. But back on point, I said, look, Trump may make everybody feel better, but I doubt there's going to be any substantive things done. And that's what I said over a year and a half ago. Looking at it after he's been in office a year and a half, I do think he has done some rearrangement of some of the worst things in Washington, but let others slide. So I don't know how far you want to go with that ball, Vinny. I'll give it back to you. I prefer to your comment and just move on to something else, but it's totally up to you. It's your show, and I'm here for your viewers and listeners.
Well, the irony is that's not how this show works. That's how everybody else's show works. And in fact, it's come to the point where I'd have somebody interrupting themselves or interrupting me or something like that, and they say, "Oh, no, go ahead, Vinny." And I go, no, it's my show. You go ahead. You know, because ultimately it is what you want to talk about. It is the questions you want to ask. And what's problematic about being an interviewer with somebody who you haven't pre-planned the show with immediately beforehand. In fact, if it's done completely on the fly, as mine are, you understand the quagmire that you don't know what questions to ask, right?
Exactly.
You do, on the other hand. What would you think would be the best question to ask yourself at this current point in time? You know, now that's an interesting question.
Exactly. Well, I will continue on the political front then for a while. I mean, you know, one of my basic premises is, of course, all about money. And the reason I focus so much on the monetary side is, one, it's my main interest. So that's number one reason. But the other reasons are that money transcends everything. I mean, whether you're from New Zealand, the United States, Guatemala, South America, Russia, China, really doesn't matter. In today's economic environment, everybody cares about money. So it transcends nation state, it transcends religion, it transcends most biases. I mean, the only people that really think more about the money than the extremely poor are the extremely rich, because they're worried about it being stolen or taken or losing it or anything else. So everyone is concerned about their money. And this is the topic that most people on shows like yours at the American Freedom Radio do understand. And with the internet, I think it's a far greater percentage than it was prior to the internet. However, there's still people that really don't understand how banking works, what fractional reserve banking is, what fiat money is, and all that. So I don't want to bore your audience, because I know almost all of them are up to speed.
If I may, I would like to encapsulate, just for the few people who don't know. Basically, back in the day, a whole bunch of people, they had really heavy gold coins, didn't want to carry them around. They gave it to some guy to carry, right? And they called him a bank. And then this bank guy realized that, hey, not everybody wants all their gold coins at the same time. So he starts giving out all these little paper receipts that are like promised gold. And he could loan out gold that didn't exist and make a hell of a lot of money and wind up buying everything, including the government. That is monetary policy, ladies and gentlemen, in a nutshell. As old as it is, today it's the same scam. And that is all that it is when it's a fiat currency. It's a scam.
Well done. Very precise, very accurate, in a nutshell. Probably better than I could have done. Yeah, so that's the problem. So the, you know, in my field, you're not allowed to guarantee anything in financial planning. You can only say, you know, probabilities, that type of thing. And I adhere to that. But we are guaranteed that every fiat currency on the planet in all of recorded history has failed. Every single one. Not one exception. So if that is the basis of our thinking, we've got to come up with an idea of any of why this one won't fail. And if you look at the Federal Reserve Board's own website, they'll tell you that the 1913 dollar is worth 3 cents today. So as I finished a lecture in London just a couple of days ago, and I use this often, you've heard this said on other interviews, but you know, if you had a first, second, third grader, son, daughter, nephew, niece, what have you, and they came back and it was a 100-point quiz and they got 3 out of 100, I think you'd call that a miserable freaking failure. And that's where the dollar is after just over 100 years. But it's gone slow enough that it's been adjusted to by the populace over that time frame with a few close calls. Close call number one in my lifetime is the 1979-1980s top of the market. I mean, gold went from 300 to 850 in a matter of about a month and a half. Silver went from $6 to $50 in a year. Silver was a panic buying at the top, and people that were overeducated, such as yours truly, actually thought it was the end of the dollar at that time, way back in 1980. And the reason being is that interest rates are a function of return. You know, this T-bill, T-bond, T-note was around almost 20%, which is mafia money in those days. I mean, extremely, this is a sovereign government, the United States government giving out almost 20%. Are you kidding me? So it's also a function of risk. So if you go to Argentina right now and look at what their bonds are paying, or Italy and look at what their bonds are paying, or you go to some of these other nation states and look at what their sovereign debt is yielding, you'll see it's extremely high. Why? Because the risk of default is extremely high. So my point being obvious, that with an interest rate that high, it looked to me like the whole thing was going to fail. But I was wrong. It didn't. In fact, the best investment you could have made in 1980 was to buy the long bond in the United States treasuries and hold that thing for 30 years, because you would have got like a 17.5% yield. And as interest rates come down, which have gone almost to zero, as we both know, the bond price goes up. So you had a 17% return year over year over year from purportedly the best currency out there, which could be argued. And you made a substantial increase on the principal amount, because the bond that you bought for $10,000 is worth substantially more over that same time frame. So
I wonder if, though, if you invested that same amount of money into lobbying the U.S. government to cut red tape on your business and create red tape for all your competitors, whether or not you would have had a better return in investment. Because it's
absolutely I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, you're right on. I mean, absolutely. I mean, this whole thing is it's a rigged game. It's fixed. It's absolutely the most immoral system going, and it's global. I mean, the only places that aren't really into the global elitist banking system is North Korea, which we're making friends with them now, and I'm not against that. Oh, I want to mention that, Vinny, because I have talked about this in the public and in my private letter. What most people don't know about North Korea, and it's very seldom discussed, is they have a huge cash of rare earth elements. And rare earth elements are like iridium, tallium, I can't even pronounce them all. But they're those elements on the periodic chart that go into your smartphone. And they're absolutely very high priced and very much needed in today's high-tech society. And most of the markets from China. But now if the U.S. and North Korea become buddy buddies, and it looks like they will, is there an ulterior motive or not? I don't know. I like peace. I hate war. Let's take it at face value, but let's add on to it a little bit. And that is that now there's a potential for the U.S. to get a hold of a lot more rare earth elements. So that's a side issue that you won't see probably in very many places except for shows like yours.
Without the need to invade, say, Afghanistan for their lithium stores.
Exactly. Yep. So he asked me what I've been up to and, you know, doing the due diligence on all things. I made a few notes here on, you know, prior to the show on what would be the most important. So coming back to the main point, all currencies have failed. The U.S. dollar is failing. We're worried about the last 3 cents of 100 and how long will it take and what will it look like? And the answer is, I don't know how long it'll take and I don't know exactly what it'll look like. What I do know is that it will look probably something similar to all other currency failures. And if you want to have a good hard look at it, the movie that you referenced, the Four Horsemen film, is a good one to start with the basic ideas of the Age of Empire and how it is basically a circular function. You go through these different ages and you go through them again, so to speak. So it's something that's a cycle that repeats again and again. And on the currency failure, there is a documentary by the PBS Public Broadcasting System, and it is it's called The Empty ATM. And you may be able to Google it. I'm not sure it's still available or not, but it's a documentary of the year 2000 failure of the Argentina currency, which of course was now failing again, which is kind of a regular thing with them. And it shows you what happens. And basically what they did in the 2000 crisis was they sort of closed the bank. So let me explain. Basically, everyone that had money in the bank didn't get Cyprus'd, but what they did was very close to being Cyprus'd, which means if you had 20,000 pesos in the bank, or let's say you had U.S., oh, I may have this part wrong. I don't want to misstate it. You had 20,000 pesos in the bank. The bank said, you have 20,000 pesos, but there's a catch. You can only withdraw 300 pesos a week, regardless of how much money of your money is in the bank. The banks hold the rules. They have your, quote unquote, your money, but you can't get to your money. You can only get to 300 pesos per week. So that's what they did, which caused a great hardship on almost all the citizens. But they managed, and they put up these, what we call flea markets in the West, or, you know, their own town squares, so to speak, where people would trade vegetables for a haircut or shoes for a coat, or an auto mechanic's work for, you know, gardening or whatever. And the people worked together and, you know, kept things going. And, of course, inevitably they issued a new currency and, you know, things got, quote unquote, better until the next failure, which is, of course, happening now. So we see it all over the world. I mean, when I wrote the book, The Silver Manifesto, I think it was from like 1990 to, I think, 95. There's something like 32 nation states that had failed currencies. The reason you don't really hear about them is, one, they're smaller countries, and two, not almost every one of them goes to the U.S. dollar. In fact, there's more dollars in physical form, you know, paper notes from, you know, issued by that private bank called the Federal Reserve outside of the U.S. than there is in the U.S. So a lot of these countries just throw their currencies in the trash bin of history and start using physical American notes as their default currency. And that's why they press on, because theirs fails, but they use the U.S. dollar as a substitute.
I thought about this as a in a different way sometimes. Like when you read the lesson of history, we often say, oh, that's an accident, or it just happened, or whatever. And I think of it, what if it was done deliberately? What if the same kind of people, not exactly the same people, not exactly the same bloodlines, whatever, but what if the same kind of people with the same sort of mentality were using the same trick throughout the entirety of human history? Well, like, what if it was a psychological thing? Like, how do I get the most power and control to satisfy my scumbaggery? Are you saying we can make money up out of thin air over here and take real assets and wield real power over people, even though there's absolutely nothing there whatsoever? Yeah. Well, that sounds like a really good investment of my time and effort. I'll go and do that. Now, as a natural reaction of that kind of person coming up with that kind of scam and being that powerful in society, it destroys, it tips that society over. And it's only a very short period of time before another person with the exact same idea, oh, we can make something for absolutely nothing and take everything with its perceived value. Oh my God, that sounds like a brilliant idea. And then he comes up with it again and again and again. What if it's a psychopathic scam, right?
I think it is. I mean, you know, I don't know if you watched the movie The International, but in that movie there's a line, I won't get it exactly right, but the essence is, you know, once you are owed the debt, you own those people or that corporation or that country. And it's like the cell phone business. You know, the cell phone companies would gladly give you the cell phone just for you to pay the monthly fee on it. In fact, a few years back in the U.S., that was fairly common. Now, with the smartphones, they don't do it so much. In fact, I don't think they do it anymore. But the idea is this: you loan the money that you create out of nothing. And then, of course, there's interest attached to it. So the bankers know from day one that the system will fail. They're really not interested in the principal or the cell phone. How much money they loan you? Now, that sounds, I'll get a lot of hate mail in the comments section, but hear me out. Basically, it revivifies what you just said, Vinny. So they loan, you know, a million, 10 million, 20 billion, you know, 500 billion, whatever the number. And they loan it at interest. They don't really expect to get the principal back. All they want is to own the debt, so they own the country, the person, the political state, the whatever, the resources of the country if you can't pay the interest. So all they care about is getting paid back the interest. They know the system is set up to fail from the day they initiate it. And our job is to enlighten enough people so when that next scumbag, psychopath, sociopath rises to the top and says, hey, I got a great idea, and it's the same old song and dance as we've always seen with a different flavor on it, and a different color, and a different face. We see it for what it is and say no more. That's our job.
There's only been a few presidents that stopped a big corporate bank from taking over America. Both of them had assassination attempts. One of them was successful, right? The second guy, Andrew Jackson, who stopped the bank, that was his dying words, his favorite achievement in all his life, "I killed the bank." Somebody tried to assassinate him with two single-shot pistols, and they both misfired. Now, there's what we call coincidence and synchronicity or what have you, and some people go to an instantly spiritual place at that moment, and you think to yourself, hey, he was being protected. He was doing what he was supposed to be doing and what have you, as opposed to that particular assassin was drunk, hadn't cleaned either of his pistols that morning, and... You know, history's a strange thing, but sometimes magic is just what you make of it. And when we talk about this system, right, the core principle that we've got here is people who want something for nothing, people who got an overarch sense of entitlement, people who weren't raised properly, okay? That's basically it. If you're not raised in an environment that teaches you to be happy, healthy, without hurting and destroying and stealing, then it's basically too late for you. You've already had your phase of development, as the Jesuits said, give me a boy until the age of 7 and I will show you the man. 95% of the things we learn before the age of 7 will go out and become our behavioral patterns, all right? That's why everybody goes... and gets really offended when you say, hey, David, you act a lot like your dad, you know? Vinny, you act a lot like your dad. And you're like, oh, my God, I'm acting like my dad. And that's the thing. We've got that sort of problem with society that actually goes to a very deep level right there at the start of the separation of the zygotes or whatever the hell, right? As soon as life begins... you've got an inherent responsibility to not traumatize, not cheat, not hurt, and that kind of thing. And if you don't do that, your child is going to grow up damaged and cause damage to the rest of society and almost anybody that they come into contact with, right? This is the inherent responsibility. Why do you think that the system has deliberately undermined the family unit in recent decades? Why do you think all of this feminism and birth control pill and the free sex, free love and all of that kind of stuff came up? It didn't come up by magic. Those movements were all financed, incidentally, by the frickin' CIA. Break down the family unit, have fun, no responsibilities. All right. What do you think was going to happen? A generation born addicted to a screen that is a 6-second attention span, that is incapable of independent thought and knows nothing but addiction their whole life. What do you think is the likelihood that people with that kind of deficit from the get-go are going to be able to rise up against their masters at any point in the future? Pretty scary thought.
Oh, very much. Well, I'll add on to that. And as you know from the Four Horsemen film, the film starts off, I think it talks about the Age of Pioneers. It goes through the whole cycle and talks about we're at the end of the Age of Empire. And one of the things that was new to me when I watched the movie the first time, because, you know, I was interviewed for, I think, 4 hours. And I don't know how many minutes I'm in the film, maybe 10. And that's all good. I loved every minute of it. Ross Ashcroft, the interview is phenomenal. And actually, I'm going to try to see him next time I'm in London in the end of July. And perhaps I'll get an interview on RT, Russia Today. But regardless about me and Ross, in the movie, at the end of the Age of Empire, there's a couple things they pointed out as the end of the Age of Empire. So first I'll add mine, which is easily proven. And you said it, Vinny. I'll just reiterate it. And that is, as the destruction of the currency worsens and worsens, the moral structure of the society declines and declines. So, you know, what was wrong in one era is okay in the next. And it's a slippery slope and things get worse and worse and worse. So in that movie, again, what hit me, among a lot of things, was that at the end of the age of the Roman Empire, that chefs were idolized. And that's been going on in the U.S. and I'm sure worldwide for quite some time now. They have all these things on the Food Network or Food Channel. I'm not a big TV watcher, but I know it exists. And I know that there's fame and glory for, you know, some of these chefs that are, you know, in different genres, barbecue and Chinese and baking and all this stuff. They've idolized because at the top of the Roman Empire, just before it started falling rapidly, you know, these people would eat and purge. You know, the rich, the ultra rich, the elite, the ruling class, if you will. So that was one. And the other one you talked about as well, and it shows it in the film, and it's this obsession with sex at the height of the empire before the collapse. So basically, it's history repeating. It's global this time, which you could argue the Roman Empire was fairly global at the time. But with the reserve currency being the U.S. dollar and everybody relying on it, and I know China's, you know, and Russia, that the BRICS have a buffer of the situation for them somewhat.
Sorry,
I don't really know.
The BRICS are what?
The BRICS are the BRICS countries: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa band together and have the Asia Investment Investment Bank, Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, and they've kind of moved away from the U.S. dollar as a dominant currency, but not totally. They've started a settlement system outside the SWIFT system, which is the Anglo-American Empire for Settlements. So when one bank settles with another or one person with another, it goes through the settlement system basically out of London. The Chinese, well, the BRICS nations, those that I named, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, have their own settlement system. And, of course, that's what this petro-yuan is all about, is that you can buy oil without having to use U.S. dollars, because the petro-dollar means that everyone has to convert whatever currency they have, Chinese yuan or Russian ruble or South African whatever, or New Zealand dollars into U.S. dollars before you can buy oil. And there's nothing more important than energy, and energy for the most part means oil. So it's a big fix. I mean, the fix was in with Henry Kissinger, because the U.S. was basically shipping a bunch of pieces of paper over to the Middle East, and the Middle Easterners were saying, you know, we're giving you something of value called oil for these pieces of paper, and we don't like it. I think we'll buy gold. They understand gold. And then this was, you know, part of the gold problem at that time, which is in the 70s. And so Kissinger either thought of it on his own or a group think or whatever, the idea being that we got to get them off of gold and we got to get them onto the dollar only. So he had this brilliant idea that, look, if you take your excess capital and buy U.S. treasuries with it, we will, and make it basically you can't settle for oil and anything but dollars, we'll have you just reinvest into the dollar through, you know, the long-term or short-term or medium-term bond market, and we'll control the world. So we're buddy buddies. And that took hold. They bought the idea. So their gold purchases slowed substantially, and they went on basically a global dollar system. And the dollar became the number one currency. Well, it already was the number one currency, but it strengthened the dollar because now everybody had to use dollars to buy oil. And, of course, that now is changing. But it's been a tough change because, as you know, Vinny, Saddam Hussein thought he would settle for oil in euros, and he ended up dead. Muammar Gaddafi thought he could settle for oil and gold, and he ended up dead. And so when you start messing with the international bankers, you know, you got to be a little careful, because when you cross their line, it can have consequences.
It occurs to me that the international bankers are also the international oil cartels. Now, it turns out that oil's ridiculously cheap, like 5 cents a barrel or something like that. And they inflated up to like $70 a barrel, and then they floated out. Now, what's interesting here in New Zealand is that back in the time, I think it was a few years ago, maybe 2012, 2011 or something like that, oil on the global market was about $140 a barrel, and it was getting up to like $2.11 New Zealand dollars at the pump per litre, right? That's about a quarter of a gallon. Now, by contrast, today we're at about $70 a barrel, and the petrol price at the pump is $2.10, right? It's a scam. It doesn't matter what the oil price is globally, because the oil price is like a couple of cents a barrel in real cost. It's cheap as chips. It comes out of the ground like a goddamn endless fountain of stuff, all right? And it's what, you know, would be a really great idea? Turning something that's worth nothing into absolutely everything that everybody needs to depend on to do everything always. Okay? If you think that you're not currently dependent on oil, folks, in every single aspect of your life, just look around you. Every single thing that has been printed, manufactured, or assembled, or anything in any way, shape, or form that involved machines or of any kind, all run on oil. All right? That's how they get you. They create something that you need. Well, they make sure that you need it, because there's infinite inventions that have popped up over the years that got suppressed or bought out by the oil companies that were really, really efficient at using it and were either good as alternative energy resources and things like that. No. We can't allow that to happen. Not until we've got a monopoly on it. That's a very simple device right there, and anybody could remake that. No. That's not allowed. Right?
So critical.
If you've got the... bring the two points together, because if you control the means of which everything gets done, and you control the means of which everything gets valued, then nobody can do anything or be of any value without your say-so. That's how one cartel can rule the world.
Yeah, well said. It brings it to mind, as you outlined, you know, if you go back to Tesla, I mean, basically it's my belief, and I've studied it fairly deeply, not total, you know, I mean, there's more research I have not done, but it looked like Tesla either had it or was very close to having basically free energy for everybody and wirelessly. And of course, with JP Morgan involved, that wasn't going to happen. He wanted a monopoly, and the whole thing, you know, literally blew up, and end of that. And of course, since that time, there's been free energy devices or minimum energy devices. I mean, there's a couple of documentaries out there I've watched on, you know, the 200 mile per gallon carburetor, and a guy ends up dead in Las Vegas from a drug overdose, and the guy never took a drug in his life, you know, this kind of thing. So, you know, don't take my word for it. Do your own research. But, you know, these people will stop at nothing. I mean, they think so little of human life that they're willing to take a life or 10 or 12 or a cunt or whatever, just to protect their positions of power. And it goes beyond money. I mean, money is power in my view, and strong view at that. But, you know, how much money do you need? And these people never have enough. So it's a situation where they can't be satisfied. But really, it's more than the money. It's control and power. And that's why the surveillance state is so important to them, because they want everybody to be tracked on everything they do, everywhere they go, almost everything they think. I mean, they want that as well. And then, of course, they will set up their command control. And, of course, will they be surveilled or not? Probably not. It's like that movie The Circle, which I don't know if your viewers are familiar with, but it's a takeoff on Google. And Tom Hanks is the CEO, and I forget who plays the character actor that's his next
Emma Watson,
line.
The Harry Potter chick.
Yeah, so they do the whole deal, and, of course, the whole thing – she flips it around on him because she puts the little camera deal on him, like, hey, let's have a look at the boss and everything that you do. And of course, they don't want that at all. They want to be behind the scenes. I mean, this is, I'm going to digress a minute, and I think you probably have some good insights, but, you know, this whole thing about, did Hillary do this or did XYZ do that, or pick your favorite flavor? Well, if the NSA is gathering data on everyone all the time, everywhere, they know damn well what's going on, but they're the problem. They're the ones that are part of the deep state. So you think they're going to blow the whistle on themselves? So, I mean, just use a little thought, people. It's like, if they've got everyone, you know, tapped out, wired, and surveilled, and, you know, everything that everyone's doing everywhere, all the time, like the all-seeing eye, you don't think that they know when a drug deal goes down or what shipment's coming in and what? Of course they do. But everyone's on the take. I mean, it's the dark state, the deep state that runs almost everything. Yeah. And again, coming back to the beginning of the interview, I think Trump has done something in that area to clean things up. At least that's my perception. And if there's a greater game, a greater scam, or something else going on, I don't really know. What I do know is that I just spoke the truth, that, you know, if anyone was legitimately wanting to take out the people that are breaking the law, they certainly could, but they don't.
It was Mike Rupert from thewilderness.com's presentation, The Truth and Lies of 9/11, where there was a clip where he asked a director of the CIA whether or not, if somebody found a government agent participating in crime and their operation was top secret, would they use that top secret classification to prevent criminal charges from being laid? Right? And the CIA director was, all of a sudden, his hands were going crazy, fumbling with himself. If you have information leading to... Right, we got you. And that's actually the ultimate thing here. What does every criminal fraternity throughout history express is the one thing that you're not allowed to do if you get busted? Snitch. You're not allowed to roll over on anybody. So what's the one thing that nobody, that everybody involved in the top secret intelligence agency circles, including the Five Eyes, that's Canada, that's the New Zealand, that's Australia, that's the UK, that's the US, working together to spy on each other and share all that information, folks? Number one rule of their criminal cult, it's classified. Same thing.
Exactly. Now, well said. So maybe come back to the monetary aspect, although this is a great thing to discuss and we can move all over. So you asked me what I've been up to. So one of the
ties into that. It ties into that because there's a whole lot of things that the Fed does with monetary policy, which can't be questioned by any other government agency. They got secret records and all of that kind of stuff. It's how their scam continues to work.
Right. When, who was it? I forget. It was, you know, a great one on Michael Rupert. In fact, I'm going to come back to Michael Rupert because I was a big fan and he's deceased, as we know. In fact, it was a suicide, unfortunately, but, you know, I didn't live in his shoes. But Mike said something I often quote, and what he said is, unless we change the way money works, we haven't changed anything. And he's right. So it goes back to, again, beginning the show, Mr. Vinny, and that is that, you know, money makes the world go round. And if we have a collapse or a reset and some other scumbag gets in there and just restarts the whole game in the same way, and everyone believes it's a change, believes it's new, believes it's going to work, and it's really just the same old scam, we haven't done anything. And that's what Mike was trying to warn us about. Unless we change the way money works, you know, nothing's going to change. And again, this is our, you know, our challenge as free thinkers that speak, are willing to speak truth to power and, you know, in some cases pay some pretty heavy consequences. And yet, you know, I think it's worth it. I think I'm called to do it. I think it's my duty to do it. But moving on, gold and silver markets have basically been sideways to down for quite some time. And there's been a lot of people that have left these markets, probably never to come back. Some will come back. And they've gone into the cryptocurrency space. So there's been a couple things in the crypto space that involve precious metals. One of them I'm involved with. We can talk about that in a moment. But the first one is beating the bankers. Because, you know, if you're given lemons, then make lemonade. Well, if you're given a lousy silver market, then how do you make money on it? Or lousy gold market? And there's a way to do it. And it's basically how to beat the bankers. I don't know. Can I do a share screen with you, or is that going
to
work?
Yeah, it should work. But you've got to remember to disable it when you want to go back to your camera.
Yeah, so there's the open conversation. Let's see. Where is that?
It should be the little three dots or the little plus symbol in between your hangout button and your microphone button.
Okay, yeah, I don't see that. Come on, baby. Microphone button.
Oh, and this actually brings up a very important point as well, that learning how to use technology, specifically communications technology, throughout history has actually kind of revolutionized the way economies work, the way knowledge gets shared. And we were talking before about how the internet's now allowing people to have these kind of discussions online and share all kinds of things. And a similar dynamic happened when Gutenberg invented the modern printer. I mean, the Chinese had invented a printer set 800 years before that, I think. But they had like 500 Chinese characters or something. So, <it's> so a little alphabet one was with punctuation was a little bit better, and that allowed people to diverge religions and make. Reports of biology, science, and what happened just a short time after that invention, well, short time comparatively, historically speaking, is the Enlightenment era, the shift in the public consciousness from believing that having faith in an all-powerful sky god that is responsible for everything and everything is the way it is, that instead you should use reason, logic, and science to evaluate things before you start believing them. That whole Enlightenment era helped because, in part, of the printing press, just the ability to share information wide enough. I believe we might be in due for a second Enlightenment era. That might be interesting. So, David, take it away. You've shared your screen.
Okay, so what you're going to have to help me, Vinny, which screen am I showing? Am I showing the blog with the Morgan Report at the top?
No, you're going to have to drag it over to the left side. You've got the look over my shoulder research report. There we go. That's about it.
Okay, so this little logo here, free webinar, beat the bankers at their own game, more details. This is a way to, literally what it says, beat the bankers. So while the bankers, remember we talked about they loan money, they don't really care about that. Now I know I'll get arguments in the comments section.
If I may, just 1 second, yeah. We are on live radio. So for those of you who aren't able to watch this online, we're at blog.silver-investor.com/precious-metals-storage-no, right? And there's a little page here that David's just reading out for us. So.
Yeah. So anyway, this little ad here is how to use derivatives. And I know I teach, you know, to have real metal first. So I don't want anyone that's followed my work closely or even at a distance knows I've always preached to buy real metals before you buy any mining companies or do anything else. But once that's established, it's up to you, as far as I'm concerned, to take care of your own finances. And there's a way to beat the bankers doing exactly what they do. And that's what this webinar is all about. It teaches you how to do what they're doing. So in other words, if the market's going up, down, or sideways, you can make money just like the bankers are making. So that's something that I've been involved with for the last 2.5 years. I just came back from London talking to their top-tier clients, which I'm involved with, on this whole program, and it works quite well. It yields about 1.5-2% per month, regardless of what's happened to gold and silver market. So people that are really burnt out on, you know, what they perceive as a manipulated market, which I agree. I have a whole chapter on them, silver manipulation in the Silver Manifesto, the second book that I wrote. So you can read that if you're so inclined. So I just wanted to point that out, Vinny. And the other thing that we made note of is this precious metal storage. I think we'd save that for more toward the end of the show. But there are people that do have to store their metal. I teach what Mike Maloney teaches. He and I are both friends, and many of my friends in the industry. And that is, you don't, you know, hold it, you don't own it. Having said that, the reality is that there's people that are, you know, many circumstances. They're elderly. They live in an apartment. They travel a lot. They have so much of it, they're scared to keep it with them. So there are really valid reasons why storing metal is a must for some people. And if that is the case, then you really have got to read the contract. But again, I digress. We can come back to that. I really want to focus on that right now. I'd rather stick more to, you know, what you got there, the Silver Manifesto. Maybe we talk more about the debt. We can talk about the currency failures. We can talk about, you know, anything you want. But that part about the Sharpe's ratio and the fact that, you know, if I was brought into court on the silver manipulation, I not only would quote myself out of that book, but I would make it explicitly clear through both technical analysis and Sharpe's ratio that it's absolutely 100% impossible to have the kind of trading in the silver market that takes place historically year over year to be a random walk.
You might want to stop sharing your screen while you're speaking so people can actually see you speak. That's how the recorder thing works.
Yeah. Now comes the challenge. Back to where was I? How do I get back? Okay.
Nope, all right, so not. the old silver manifesto. Yes. Word manifesto is quite interesting because it also becomes it's almost political when you come down to it. Actually, when you look at a lot of precious metals and the way people actually feel about it, it doesn't feel like they're talking about something financial. It feels like they're talking about something political. Why is that?
Well, I think the two are really tied together at especially certain points in history. I mean, if you look at the history of the Weimar Republic. What do you remember? Do you remember the politics or the money problem? Well, you remember, most people remember the money problem. Of course, it was all political. And remember, this is what astounds people. But the cry of the populace on the whole rise up in the Weimar Republic was, there's not enough money. Now, how can there not be enough money, Vinny, when you got to go to the store with a wheelbarrow full of printed notes to buy a donut? And while you're in the store negotiating if you got enough weight of this paper, the guy dumps the paper on the ground and steals the wheelbarrow because it's more valuable. And yet, there wasn't enough of it. This is what happens when the whole system collapses. And that's a hyperinflationary scenario, obviously. But this is the problem that we have seen. And again, going back to the beginning, the U.S. dollar's worth 3 cents of what it used to be. But yet, it's happened slowly enough that it's the boiling frog. You know, people now, a lot of people, especially, people like... they listen to you and others, of course, know that they have jumped out of the boiling water and they protected themselves somewhat financially with gold and silver. But there's a lot of other problems that, and I don't look at every show you do, but I'll digress a bit. I mean, what you're doing with the marijuana thing and the cannabis and, so many good things about hemp. And, you're with this all caps situation and the government's just, repressing. I mean, being a libertarian of thought and being a free thinker for most of my life, I mean, this idea that some yo-yo yokel know-nothing has the right to tell you how you can live, what you can eat, what you can drink, where you can go, when you can do it, when you have to be to bed, when you have to get up, and all this nonsense. That's all this Pavlovian dog syndrome that the bell rings and you get out of bed, the bell rings and you finish your breakfast, the bell rings and you check in at work, the bell rings and you get a break, the bell rings and you get lunch. I mean, and yet people do it every day and don't even see that they're into that whole system without ever having had basically an original thought their whole lives. I mean, I think the most sorry thing, and I'm getting philosophical, is to go through your whole life and know that you never even lived one.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of people refuse to believe the truth about life when they hear it, because it's actually quite a traumatic freaking realization, and it's going to make you angry. It's going to make you try to negotiate with this truth and whatever, find your own little piece of it. And then when you realize you can't do that, that you have to face it, you start getting depressed because you don't want to face it. You'd rather just wallow in sadness and grief and pain and about, oh, my life, it's all wasted. And it's hard. I'm not going to lie. We make light of it, but that's only because we had to brave the darkness.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the coin dealers I used to associate with more heavily than I do now, he actually got sick. But, we had this philosophical discussion years and years ago, maybe almost 20. And it's like, well, why do so few people actually pick up that 2,000-pound phone and call the coin dealer and buy some real metal? And you just answered it. It's because it's actually letting their innermost self, it's being true to themselves, saying, I actually believe that there is a problem and that I can do something about it. And then I'm going to actually take action, because once I get those gold coins or those silver coins, it's a statement to themselves, conscious and subconscious, saying, there is a chance. All monetary systems have always failed. That's a fact. Two, I understand that now. Three, it's likely to happen to this one. Four, maybe I should actually take some actions and prevent it from happening. But once you do that, now you've joined a truther club, and you're one of those people that has to wear a tinfoil hat and be called a conspiracy theorist for the rest of your life. And gee whiz, that might hurt my little ego. That might hurt my feelings. What will my family think? No, I don't think I'll do anything. These are great entertainment shows, Vinny. You're a great guy, Vinny, but I'm not going to do anything about it.
It said that basically, for everything that you get told that's completely opposite to your current belief structure, you'll tell that person to fuck off. They're a conspiracy theorist. But for every seventh person at a seventh different time from a seventh different social circle comes up to you and says that exact same thing that's opposed to your ideological beliefs, you'll consider changing them. What that means is that if you are person number one, two, three, four, doesn't matter which one you are, you've got an obligation to just say one thing. And you will help to pierce the veil for these people who know nothing currently. They'll remember at one point in their life, hey, oh, so that's what that person was talking about, randomly. Now, what this means is you have to do it dispassionately. You can't be emotionally invested in somebody else waking up. That's going to make you very disappointed, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to go out and tell everybody 9/11's an inside job, and they're going to believe me because I've got facts and evidence on my side. They've got neuroses and brainwashing on their side, bro. Trust me. Neuroses and brainwashing are infinitely more powerful than facts and evidence alone. And you've got to understand that fact. I know it's not fair. You're not the army, ladies and gentlemen. You're the resistance. How does a resistance work versus an army, you ask? Well, a resistance has to supply for itself. A resistance has to take care of itself. A resistance has to watch the person next to them. An army has somebody already there in that position who's paid specifically to do that so that you can focus on your one compartmentalized thing. Kill the enemy. Right? Resistance ain't like that, ladies and gentlemen. You've got to think of it holistically. Otherwise, the whole resistance fails if each and every individual within it does not take responsibility for the things which are their obligation. And that obligation is merely to resist. You don't have to win. You don't have to fight. You just shouldn't give in. You shouldn't do nothing. It's a very simple realization. Ask yourself, today, am I doing nothing against the scumbaggery of the world? Am I not educating myself about it? Am I doing nothing about it? Am I not spreading the word about it? Am I not living a life of example that lives in opposition to the way the system wants me to act? If the answer to any of those questions is, yeah, I actually am doing some of those things today, then you're doing all right. And don't feel guilty that you haven't accomplished X goals. Don't feel like those will never happen. Nobody will appreciate me that much. Everybody ignores me or whatever. Yes, they do. But you shouldn't care as much as they do about not caring about you. But yeah, that's my two cents.
Very good. Well, I think we can segue in. I think are we going to have a break at the top of the hour?
We are going to have a break almost momentarily. I always get confused with the breaks on this network. In fact, if we were having a break, there'd be no way to know because sometimes the music doesn't come in and what have you. But the one thing I'd keep forgetting to do, ladies and gentlemen, is say thank you very much for actually supporting the show. All the little automatic payments that come in through the Kiwi Bank from my New Zealand listeners, that lets me know that there are people right here at home that support what I do on an international level. And all of those people who are making those automatic payments through the PayPal as well. Ladies and gentlemen, you're beautiful. And all of those people who regularly give every single month through signing up at Patreon, you're beautiful. And I cannot do this without that encouragement, right? It's kind of like a symbiotic relationship. The people enjoy the show for all sorts of different reasons. And regardless of what the reason is, thank you for allowing it to exist. That's all I really wanted to say. So for those of you who do want to sign up, thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, that's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood, like, go ahead. Make my news. is the place where you can donate and see all the links there and what have you, as well as patreon.com/Vinny Eastwood. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show. It's on AmericanFreedomRadio.com every week for your listening pleasure. Now, I do want to have a little bit of announcement. Wife tells me we're a little bit short on the rent money this week. So, folks, due to an unforeseen financial income withdrawal, we need a little bit of help over there at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We need about $250 New Zealand, maybe that's about $180 US or something like that, to cover our costs for this week. So if you are able to give generously or even start up an automatic payment, if you're from New Zealand, there's a Kiwi Bank there on the homepage, or become a Patreon for the month, or start up an automatic payment through PayPal. Those really, really help to keep the costs paid in an ongoing way. And I appreciate that not everybody is able to do that, because income these days, in a criminal slanted deck and economy, any cent, any dollar goes a heck of a long way for me. And I really do appreciate each and every one of you that donate with all my heart. My very special guest, David Morgan, the Silver Guru, is back joining us for the second hour. Welcome back, David. What were we talking about before the break there on the other thing? It was something you wanted to go into. I forget what it is. I'm sorry.
Well, me too, and I'm older than you, so I have an excuse. But during the break, I went out and got the third book, and we can touch on this if you want, Vinny, but it's Second Chance. And
I just want to note on the irony that your third book is The Second Chance.
Yeah, thanks for that. No one's picked up on that. Went totally over my head. David named the book. David Smith and I wrote the book. And I actually would have probably told David no, not that I have a lot of control, and I don't like to control people. But there's a book, Second Chance, by Robert Kiyosaki, and there's a couple. So it's a little confusing. But the subtitle is How to Make and Keep Big Money from the Coming Gold and Silver Shockwave. And the reason I wanted to, you know, get the book is, look, I'm not making any money on these books. I want to make that perfectly clear. You know, it's a $20 bill US to buy the book, certainly worth it in my view. But the point is that 90% of the move comes in the last 10% of the time. So there are people out there that probably bought silver and don't like it now, or bought gold or whatever, and it's been a miserable 5 or 6 years. And I admit that. However, the crypto market isn't as strong as it used to be either. And when things start unraveling even further than they already have, and that last 3 cents of the dollar's value from what it was about 100 years ago starts to unravel rapidly enough for more people to get out of their cognitive dissonance and say, you know what? As you said, that fourth person says, oh, yeah, he's right, and runs to the gold dealer, or runs to the store to buy food, or it goes wherever. Remember, that will take these metals very, very high, very, very rapidly in paper terms. And all markets go from undervalued to fair value to overvalued. And when the gold and silver markets are overvalued, I will put out a call to sell, or at least sell some, depending on the economic conditions. Obviously, if the currency is failing, I wouldn't say sell your silver and buy this currency that's probably not going to be worth anything 2 weeks out. But I don't think that's what it's going to look like. I think that the bankers that seldom lose will put out the scam that you so eloquently went over at the beginning of your show and said, you know, some other scumbag is going to come up out of the ashes and say, I got a solution. Look at this shiny little tokenized coin that's backed by blah, 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 blah. And all you got to do is put it on your phone and things will be wonderful again. And it's the same old story. It's the same old, you know, it's a second beginning for everybody that buys into these dictatorial powers, these sociopaths that run the banking system. So again, I've said this 3 times, I'll probably say it 3 more before we close out the show. It's our responsibility to say yes or no when this new system comes up. And I think the bankers are already thinking of plan A, B, C, D, and E as far as how are they going to implement the new plan. However, there are random events in the universe. There are things that cannot be predicted. In fact, I would say from my perspective that the deep state's angst against President Trump, a lot of it, I think, is real. And I think that they really thought they had locked in HRC to become the next president, and all of this dirt and slime will be put under the carpet and things will go back to their way of basically controlling the world and putting all of us useless eaters in our proper place. And I think they're pretty stunned when Trump actually gained the presidency. But I digress.
Well, come back. Found that it was a, there's also a cycle, not only with the collapse of empires, but there's a cycle in collapse of presidencies. And some presidents do something, some presidents do something bad, and then one president comes in to distract everybody from the bad stuff that both of the bad people did. And apparently now that this is the distraction era, it's like, why are we having all these sexual cases about things like that? Because it brings you to attention, doesn't it? It gets you focusing on it, doesn't it? All of these big photo opportunities for shaking Kim Jong-un's hands. What's going on behind the scenes? What are the deep state doing behind the scenes whilst everybody's focusing on the president who runs nothing?
Yeah. No, well said. That did bring to the fore something that Trump does have a picture of Andrew Jackson in the Oval Office, which I find interesting. You know, he's for me, he's a very interesting character to try to figure out. I mean, is he anti-deep state or not? I really don't know. Does he act as if he's anti-deep state? Yes, he does at times. And yet there are people that are firmly in the what I'll call establishment and subtext deep state that are in the Trump administration. So he's a very interesting character to try to put a handle on, at least for me. Nonetheless, the system is continuing to go down this path. And even if we do get a reset, even if there's a debt jubilee, even if there is all the stuff that I have forecast along with many others, and it does take place, you know, it doesn't mean that it wasn't all orchestrated, you know, way back when, and everyone just thinks it's a random event and thinks that the bank closure was something that just occurred and the banks, you know, the markets got out of control. Well, very little happens by error in politics or by randomness. Almost everything is just a green screen with a bunch of crisis actors jumping up and down with the mainstream propaganda press telling you how to think, and about 90-something percent of the population goes, oh, yeah, oh, I knew that. Yeah, sure.
Just to back that up, the CIA officially in Laurel Canyon has larger film studios than all the major film studios combined, and has nearly 10 times the amount of finished films than all the major film studios in the world combined. Right? A lot of what we think is news, facts, etc., is actually produced to give us a particular view of reality.
No, it is so true. I mean, well, if you go back to the film, The Four Horsemen, there were some very smart people in there, and I won't say I am. I'm not trying to say that. What I'm saying is there were. And Julian Tennant, that still works at the Financial Times, I thought her statement on the kind of the, what do you call it, the trailer for the movie. And she said, you know, about the movie, that it's the cognitive map that's the most important, which is just a fancy English way of saying, if you can control the way people think, you've got it. And she's exactly right. If you control how they think paper money good, or little inflation good, or governments are all powerful, I don't know anything, or someone better be a bank, I don't know what to do, or money's too difficult to figure out, or economics, I hate it, it's disgusting, I don't know anything about it, just make sure my check clears. And all this stuff that's basically, again, propaganda that's foisted on the masses, and most of these people think it's their own idea when it's really propaganda. They've been spoon-fed and they've been programmed to think that way.
What is the difference between teaching somebody what to think and preventing them from knowing how to think?
Absolutely. One of my favorite topics. I'm going to digress. This is one of my favorites. I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, for those that don't know and don't care. I'm not giving you my life story, but I was born in San Francisco, California. And I spent most of my life, except the last 20 years, when I'm in Washington State, not the District of Criminals. But in California, I went to this solar place because I've been interested in alternative energy for a long time. And this is well over 27, 8 years ago. Anyway, I'm up there randomly because I've been to this place a couple times, and I just happened to drive. It was about an hour and a half drive. And it's this huge amount of cars all over the place. And I've been to this place like twice before, and it was kind of like, you know, driving a parking lot and there's two more cars. It was pretty remote in Northern California. And it was basically all alternative energy, mostly solar, but some wind. And there's this huge festival, the solar festival. I just randomly picked that day. Well, I drove all that way, so I'm not real big on big crowds, but, you know, I'm already there. I'm going to take advantage of it. So I get in the crowd, and here comes Ralph Nader. For those in New Zealand that don't know, Ralph Nader is kind of the Green Party, and he came in on a Porsche that was basically an electrically powered Porsche. It was an older car that was modified by, prior to Tesla, and it was a one-off. It didn't go very fast. It was more for show than go, but he's sitting in this convertible on the rear deck, and someone's driving it in, and they drive a whole whopping quarter mile, and he gets up on stage. So I said all that to say this, because it's vitally important. It goes right to the heart of what you said, Vinny. He said when he was a kid, he and his brother would be asked by their dad questions at the dinner table to get them, you know, the discussion going, you know, families without looking at a little black screen, you know. And so one night he asked them, "What were you taught in school today? Were you taught to think or were you taught to believe?" That's it, folks. They're all taught to believe. No one's taught to critically think. And that's exactly what you said a moment ago, Vinny, and touche, because this is what we need to do. We need to get away from the programming and into critical thinking. And as you said, it's becoming more and more difficult because everybody's on these little black screens about a foot and a half from their nose all day long. And they think that they know what they're doing. They think that they're getting all this critical information. Sure, you can Google almost any topic and regurgitate it and read it off or have it read to you or whatever. That's not my point. The point is you are almost a middleman with very little human interaction. It's almost the machine running.
You've been reduced to being a middleman in your own life.
Yeah.
You're just jockeying your own paperwork for a living. That's what doing this is.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And that, you know, it's very difficult. I mean, my kids are 23 and 24. My oldest soon to be 25. The point is that, the cell phones were around. They both had them at fairly young ages, I think, around 12, 13. But, you know, these kids now, the smartphone's only been around for, I don't even know what, 6, 7 years. I don't even know. But, you know, the sophistication, I mean, these are mini computers now. And I don't want to be a hypocrite. I'm on mine fairly often because I have to listen to, you know, stuff like the Vinny Eastwood Show to make sure I don't miss much. I mean, you go back just 15 years or even 10, I could pretty much with my two analysts, myself, my webmaster, maybe a random subscriber sending me an email or two, pretty much keep up with everything. Now, things are happening so quickly throughout not just the financial world, but everything, the weather, water, the GMOs, the political structure, the infighting, everything that's happening. It's accelerating, at least from my perspective, and it's really difficult to keep up with it. And it's really difficult to separate it's somewhat difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff. I mean, I look at anything and everything from the mainstream media as 100% totally fake to start with. That's my basic premise. If it's got a CNN, MSNBC, ABC, Fox, I don't care who, it's, as far as I'm concerned, my initial reaction is 100% fake. And if I go to somebody like you or whatever, the initial is it's probably true or most likely mostly true. And that's where I start. But I always have to do my own due diligence and make my own discernment and my own. And sometimes you cannot get enough cold, hard fact to be absolutely sure. There's a lot of gray in life, but I've gone way off the rails, Vinny. Maybe you could bring me back, but I'm having a great time on your show. And I do get philosophical, but I really, again, what I said earlier, it is very disheartening to me being, you know, my senior years now to see the most important part, I think, of my life as far as having youth and vitality and all that energy, and see these young kids just wasting their lives walking across the street with these stupid things in their hand and not even tuned into the world whatsoever at all. It's a very sad, sad state of affairs.
It's much easier to control someone who's already controlled by a programming that they've chosen themselves. You know, hey, look at this over here. What the hell is that? It's something in my hand. What is it in your hand? It's a device. What kind of device? It's a mind control device. Oh, really? Oh, I don't really want it there. But if you tell them it's a phone, it's communications, it's video, it's everything, you know, it allows you to stay connected with everything. They go, oh, really? Man, that'll make my life so much easier. That'll save me so much time. And then by the end of the day, you realize that you've got decision fatigue. You know what that is, ladies and gentlemen? It's after you spend 45 minutes doing something, concentrating on it, you start to get tired, your decisions become less qualitative. Let me explain this. If you've got a criminal conviction coming up, right, you go before a judge between the hours of 9 and 11 a.m. before the judge starts to get angry and hungry, you have a 60% probability of a favorable outcome in front of that judge. If it's after 11 a.m., after decision fatigue has set in, you have close to a 90% negative outcome on average coming through that judge. We've been trapped by a concept called time. It has been used to enslave us for quite some, what? Time. All right. And what these entrepreneurs were telling me about was this. I was talking to, I think it was Jeffrey Slater. I'm going to get him back on the show again anyway. The guy talks to billionaires and has these big conferences, entrepreneur conferences and things like that. A very interesting guy. And he said that the difference between somebody who goes to their job every day and a billionaire who does what they want every day is the way that they look at time. A person looks at their watch to check what time they have to be somewhere or have to be doing somewhere. The other person looks inside their heart and thinks, what should I be spending my time on right now? Should I be having a drink? Should I be getting some water or should I be having lunch? Or do I actually feel like working on this particular project right now for about 45 minutes and then, yeah, that's good, I'm going to take a break, all of that kind of stuff. And essentially what the difference is, you get a massive amount of increase in productivity the more breaks you actually have, right? On average, and I think they've applied this in schools in Finland, a child will spend 15 minutes out of every hour at play. Out of every hour, right? And they found that that helps concentration, that helps people to learn, that helps people to be better, right? When we're regimented, when we're a slave to the clock, when it doesn't make any sense and it's outside of our natural rhythms, we get stress, we get cancer, we get illnesses, we get depression, we get all of these negative things, right? These are not isolated either, because 20% of people allegedly suffer from some form of mental illness. And I think that being tired and not getting enough breaks and having a really, really stressful life classifies, doesn't it? Because what causes all of these things? It's all connected. What we're doing and who we're becoming becomes our choice. But only once we know that we've got a choice. Somebody actually has to sit you down and say, hey, you're now an adult. You have to clean up your own room now. I'm not going to do that for you anymore or tell you to do it. You have to drop yourself off at work now. You know, we're not children anymore. And I think what's largely happened on a societal level with the advent of technology, especially, and I've noticed this myself with watching, playing computer games and watching movies and things like that, I was like, oh my God, I was still doing this as a child and I haven't grown out of it yet. Our entertainment spaces have become childhood regression centers where we go back to being children and we look at the state as our father and mother. We look up at them with some kind of respect as though they're there to protect us. And all of these messages that are coming through these fields, all through our computer games and our entertainments, our TV shows, our movies, all programming our view of reality. So if we're seeing nothing but crisis in the media about everything, but if you ever look at the statistics over here and you say that there's less homeless people today than were ever before, less hungry people today than were ever before, a lot better environmental regulations in places that are now flourishing when previously they were really messed up, it's actually, we're living longer. We're technically a bit happier, right? If you look at the statistics over the aggregate. But you never hear that. You only hear about the things that are going wrong. They don't tell you that we're actually making progress. I hear a lot of people hopeful, especially politicians. Oh, I'm very hopeful we can get this accomplished and so on and so forth. But I remain very, very cynical. Yet I also remain unaffected by what crisis that there is going around me. Unless it's affecting me directly, I don't worry about it because it's outside of my control, and if things are outside of my control, I cannot affect them. Ergo, stressing about them is going to do me undue harm. Not a smart idea. Crisis is not my fucking game, folks. Chilling out, having a good time, having a laugh while the world collapses around us. That's more my bag, all right? Like... What else are you going to do? I mean, I'd be Nero. Man, my city's burning around me. I think I might play my fiddle. Again, sorry, that was quite a considerable rant. I just occasionally have stuff to get off my chest and I don't stop until it's out. Sorry, David.
No, I'm enjoying it. Well, I think I'll bring us back to the silver world for a minute. I put out this tweet earlier this morning. This is a headline, and it is, India's silver use triples in a decade. World share up from 14.7% to 39.2%. Silver investors bought silver in 2011 when it peaked, and many are holding on, avoiding booking losses. Only a few smart ones have averaged the cost at lower prices. Silver consumption in India has increased multifold the past decade, going by a report on the precious metals released by the Silver Institute. So I'll stop reading there. But this is an interesting article, but really, it's not just India. If you look at the silver statistics going back about 15 years, so the early 2000s, the amount of silver used for industrial purposes was roughly 35% of the market. Today, the industrial demand, according to this Silver Institute study, there is another one, the industrial uses for silver is about 55% of the market. So India is just verifying what I just said. But what's so interesting about that is that the industrial use has gone from 35 to 55% over the last 15 years, is that the supply of silver has increased dramatically from the year 2003 till now. If you go back to 2003, the amount of silver mined annually is about 600 million ounces, and now it's about 800, 850 million ounces. So the use went from 35 to 55 the whole time, except for the last 3 years where it's been flat, that silver production, mining supply, has increased over and over and over again. So that's quite a feat to have an increase in supply that I just outlined, and such an offtake for industrial uses that it continued to increase.
What technology was developed during that time in the silver industry that made the production go up so high?
Smartphones and solar, primarily.
That was the demand. How did they? I'm talking about the raw extraction of the resources.
The supply. I'm sorry, I anticipated your question. Forgive me, Vinny. No, what it was the China Industrial Revolution, I'll call it, from roughly the year 2000. China was building at a rate that was probably never seen before, even including the Industrial Revolution. So there was need for copper, zinc, lead, all the commodities. And silver is produced 70% as a byproduct of lead, zinc, copper, and gold. So as the world needed more copper, you're going to get more silver. Of course, there's more silver needed too, of course, for, as I said, solar and electronics. Anything electrical or electronic usually has silver in the equation somewhere along the line. So flat screens, microwave ovens, electrical switches, washing machines, smart refrigerators, and on it goes. But no, the demand was met by this huge surge in productive capacity of China primarily.
That's interesting. How did that affect the overall price of silver, though? Because, you know, they talk about these laws. Like, basically, when you get taught economics, you get taught a whole bunch of made-up rules that don't make any sense. And the reason why that is because they're lies made by the scam artists who run the economy into the ground. So, basically, they come up, oh, this supply and demand, you know. Oh yeah, so suddenly the supply increases and the demand increases, but the price stays virtually the same, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you could get into details in my book, but the point is exactly well taken. Basically, the supply is the amount of paper silver you can produce, which is infinite, versus the physical offtake, which has been met by this increase in supply that happens from the year 2000. And the main thing, and you've alluded to it several times, maybe you spit it right out in plain English, but it's the psychological effect. I mean, if you could convert, you know, if you could get the cognitive map, as Julian Tennant said in the movie, and control the way people think, if you get them to think silver, not good now, and basically give up on it, which has been done, basically happened in my view, my studied view, around the $26 level. Once gold went under $15.50 and silver went under $26, there was a psychological shift that basically is gold is no good, silver is no good. But you got to remember, if you go back when I started the website from basically 2000 up to 2011, gold was up 11 or 12 years in a row. And gold was one of the better performing assets, and silver was absolutely the best asset class you could buy for like 4 years in a row. So we certainly had our heyday. Now, there are naysayers that said it's had its day and it's done. And that remains to be determined. I'll be honest. It remains to be determined. I think is a better word, that we have one more move up, as I said earlier, Vinny, with this book, The Second Chance, which is my third book. That you're not laughing. So that
I'm sorry. It's going to get stuck in your head now every time you go on somebody else's show. This is my third book, Second Chance.
I'll start laughing for no reason.
It's like, you know, when there's something funny in church or, you know, you can't help it.
But the big move lies ahead, I believe, and it's going to be the biggest move of all time. There's going to be more people making so much money at the end of the cycle that it'll be very, very interesting. And of course, there'll be competing currencies that we're seeing. This is something, in fact, I'm going to digress a bit on the cryptos, because the cryptos are very interesting indeed. I do not profess to be an expert on them whatsoever. However, what I do know from studying monetary history is that at the top of these paper fiat scams, the people start to look for alternatives. So in the modern era, with the, you know, smartphones, et cetera, it's only really a natural thing to look for something in the electronic world that will be a replacement currency. So basically, if you take it philosophically, the cryptos are all about an alternative currency. And most people believe, and in some cases I don't, that these are basically free market enterprises that are thought up by individuals and came to the market because there was a demand for an alternative money, and so be it. My studied view is that Bitcoin was basically based on a white paper that was submitted by the NSA years before Bitcoin hit the streets, and very few people are aware of that fact and prefer to deny that and rather look at how much they made in the Bitcoin world rather than was the CIA or NSA involved in this? And I think that they were. But that's way off on a limb. You can probably bring me back in or perhaps.
Well, basically, I call it Fuckham's razor, which is if there's two possibilities, one of which is really, really fucked, that's probably the truth.
Yeah. Well, InQtel, or how you say it, InQtel, I think is how you pronounce it, is the CIA's investment bank or investment, what do you call it, their little investors group for, you know, capital in these extreme cases. And they were investors in Bitcoin very early on. So there's a lot of factors, if you actually care to dig out and research it, to find out that InQtel and the NSA probably had a hand in Bitcoin. Now, whether they have it all or not, not all of them, but I mean, have something significant or not, you know, I think they may. So this is something that, again, you know, as I said earlier, we've batted back and forth. I mean, whatever the next system looks like, going back to Michael Rupert, I mean, if we don't change the way it works, we haven't changed anything. It doesn't mean working off your phone with a cryptocurrency. No, no, no. That's not what he means by we have to change the way it works. We have to change the way it works, meaning that the central control doesn't exist. And that's the big push for these cryptos, is there is no central authority. But I question that in some cases, not in all cases.
Yeah. All things can be infiltrated over time. All things.
I think so. Yeah.
Right. And nothing good lasts forever, that old chestnut. I think it's absolutely true. Because unless we remain vigilant, what it is that those before us have fought for won't exist anymore. Right? It's essentially you take obligations from the previous generation handed down to you, and then your obligation is to look at the next generation as you are handing it off to them, more or less. Nowadays, we don't have quite so many people electing to have children, and if they do, it's only a few. And a lot of these obligations to plant a tree whose shade you know you shall never sit beneath. Your obligation to think not of yourself and not of your children, but of those that are yet to even be born, the children of your children. Think about that in the long term. A lot of old cultures, like China, for example, they do this, and it reflects in their economic policy. So they go into countries now, the People's Liberation Army intelligence, and have made a deal with triads, the Chinese mafia, to send citizens into Western nations, buy their passports up. In some cases, you can buy government bonds in exchange for citizenship for you and your family, to purchase local houses, local businesses, not change the names of the businesses, and just continue to run them and tell their children to study very, very hard and to try and get government jobs, so that at the time when an approval is needed by the Chinese government's interests, they will have somebody already in place. And ladies and gentlemen, this plan's been in the works for quite some time, and indeed Vancouver, Canada, years ago, was reported as being 80% Chinese-owned, the downtown area, 80% Chinese-owned. And they reported that there were triads operating in every major port in Canada. Every major port. Not just most of them, all of them. Infiltration, ladies and gentlemen, it happens. It's happening today. And the Chinese aren't the only ones doing it. Your own intelligence agencies are working together through the Five Eyes network to promote globalism, to insert their puppets into foreign countries. There is a silent war going on behind the scenes. Most people are completely unaware that this war even exists. And that's the way they'd like to keep it, isn't it? Now, there's another element here which I wanted to get out is, I've been listening to Alan Watts a little bit lately, a video here or there, and he said there's one thing that was particularly interesting, like when you're trying to give up a bad food or a cigarette or drink or whatever, as soon as you make a decision, I'm not going to do this anymore, all of a sudden the temptation comes flowing through the door, you get all these invites from people, hey bro, do you want to go have a drink? And he says, you should never put the devil on notice. Because who do you think the devil is? And I was just like, I was gelling on that for a second, because when you're living your life and you're just doing the right thing, and you know, you don't have like goals and everything like that, but everything just can kind of just keeps going, right? But when you start to make decisions and promises and all of that sort of stuff, everything gets left awry. It's the ancient conundrum: how do you desire to not desire without having the desire to not desire? Right? This kind of thing that we're living in is messing with our heads, because the things that we want get go further away from our grasp the harder we try to get towards them. It's a very, very strange thing. But it's one of those interesting elements that you see at work with governments and control mechanisms as well. The tighter they squeeze us, the more of us slip through their fingers. Right? The more, what was the old saying? How do you expose a fascist? By making them act like it. Right? But a lot of people are going and against the system. They make videos against that particular bad, evil person, against that bad particular. It doesn't work. That person then gets to claim victim status, don't they? And can get your video removed. They can take you to court, so on and so forth. Because you're putting the devil on notice. And now the devil knows what you're doing. Why do you think I don't ambush people anymore, ladies and gentlemen? Go up to the Prime Minister and the Minister of Justice and all of that kind of stuff like I used to do in the first couple of years. Because I learned. That just makes you a target. It gives you attention, unwanted attention. And that the best thing to do is not to actually attack the things you hate. It's to support the things you love. Right? The things that actually make you feel warm inside. Those things that actually make you feel inspired to do it. Do you feel that when you're writing?
Yeah, you know, my sister taught me this one. I don't know if it's true, it's hearsay, but I trust my sister. But Mother Teresa purportedly was asked, you know, will you march against war? She says, I'm not against anything. I'm for peace, which is what you just said. You know, do those things that you love. And, you know, there's so much distraction today. We've talked about it during your show the whole time. But I think it's time, as a metaphor for everybody, you know, whatever, to take a deep breath and pause. You know, I've been a meditator for years. I learned transcendental meditation when I was about 22 years of age, and I will not look you in the eye and say I've done it every day since, but almost every day since. And not TM, I've learned other techniques, and, you know, I'm on an airplane, I use a technique that's different than one at my house, and blah, 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 blah. But starting with some centered peace every day, regardless of what's going on around you, I think it's a great way to start your day. It's plus it centers me, but I only speak for myself. But this balance, we're so out of balance, Vinny. And I know you cover, I mean, one of the shows that you did, I listened to twice, was that fellow, I forget his name, I give him credit, that talked about distilled water and what the really good water is, you know, and
Andrew,
you know,
Norton Weber.
Yeah, taking a tangent from there, I mean, everything that I can think of is corrupted. I mean, the air is corrupted, the food supply is corrupted, the water is corrupted, the political system is corrupted, the monetary system is corrupted, the education system is corrupted, the healthcare system is corrupted. So, you know, that adage that, you know, what if everything you believe to be true isn't, is a good place to start. Because this is basically the world we're living in. But as you said, you throw just one little piece of that at someone the wrong way, i.e. directly. Like, Vinny, don't you know 9/11 was an inside job? No, you got to do as you suggest. You've got to do it indirectly. In fact, what I've liked to do, and I used to do it with my kids fairly often, was not even look at them or direct them. I would say it to like a third party that was over visiting the house. And I'd say, you know, it's really interesting how much I really started to enjoy going to school once I learned to read on my own and knew I had a choice of picking up whatever book I wanted to read. You know, well, that's a subtle, hey, kid, go out and read more. But I didn't say, hey, Katie, I would literally like you to read more. I demand you go in your room and read a half hour right now. No, no, no. It's an indirect comment to an adult, which you subconsciously, you know, look at an authority figure my dad is saying, geez, he really started to love learning when he started reading more and realized he had a choice of what to read. Maybe I'm belaboring the point, but I'm getting to your point that this is the way to approach it. As you said, you go directly to the prime minister and say, hey, you scumbag, you throw a pie in his face. Might be good for a few laughs and you might get, you know, 400,000 views on that video. But if you're sitting behind bars for the next 2 months, it didn't really do you much good.
I think it's that that oppositional thing, because most of the creative parts within ourselves are merely waiting to be expressed, waiting to have time spent on them. It's kind of like a child. The most important resource you can spend on your children is time, essentially. And if you don't have any, then you've got all that time to work on yourself. And for each moment that you're not working on yourself, that's a worse you tomorrow.
Yeah, well said. I certainly like what you said about the billionaires, not because of the monetary status, but the freedom and the ability to create their own day and basically, you know, create their own day. Whereas if you're, you know, 9-to-5-er, as we call it here in the States, you know, your day is plotted out. Oh, your exact workload or what you eat for lunch or if you go out to lunch. I mean, those are little itty bitty decisions that are basically meaningless in the great scheme of things. It gives you the idea that you have control, you have a choice. But basically, if you're in the corporate world, that corporation owns you, and you're there 9-to-5. And if your boss comes up at 4:30 and says, hey, I got to get this thing done tomorrow, you know, you got to do it. Can you work late? And you have, you know, an appointment to see your kid's Little League game. A lot of times you'll cancel the Little League game because the boss told you you've got to finish this. And even though you made a commitment to your kid, you don't want to lose your job because you live in fear most of your life. And this is the way the world runs for the most part. And it's sad. It's really sad that because it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, if we go all the way back to, you know, if everyone had free energy, think of what the world would look like. I mean, just think if everybody had the ability to not worry about, you know, power, electricity, transportation. I mean, this is an idea that I don't think is really that far off. Obviously, we don't have it now. Obviously, the mafia control freaks are in charge of it, and they make us pay for everything. But I do, going back to what I said earlier, I think Tesla had the ability to do that. And it's been, you know, taken away from us. So, you know, I think the what we want, I'm speaking for others, I still don't speak for myself, the way I see it, imagine a world where your basic needs are taken care of and you don't have to worry about shelter, energy, food, or transportation. Everybody on the planet had that. Now think of the creative capacity that everybody would have. I mean, wow, you know, think about real peace. You know, I think the United States is in like 52 countries. I mean, I have to be, you know, honest about the military industrial complex. I mean, how many of those 50 countries said, hey, come on in, set up a base and watch everything we think, do, and say. We're really loving life with you sitting there, you know, in our country.
Not to correct you there, but there's actually three countries where there aren't any U.S. forces in the entire globe. Out of like 257 countries, there are three that don't have active U.S. forces in them right now.
I don't mind being corrected. No, thank you for that. Yeah.
It makes it sound a lot worse when you think of it like that, when you think of global empire, right? Oh, it's in every single country, basically, but a couple... Oh, okay. This is the world government.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. Well, maybe we should take off on that a little bit. I just heard this recently. I mean, not that recently, but, you know, you've got these city-states that are entirely sovereign unto themselves. You've got the Vatican, which I guess is the religious arm. You've got London, which is the financial arm. And then you've got the District of Criminals, which is the military arm. And this is basically the three sisters that are running the Five Eyes that are doing everything that, you know, and looking at us as absolute plebes. We're absolute, in their view, worthless eaters. We're only there to serve them. We're part of their system, which means no matter what you do for a living, be it in the corporate world or on your own, you owe them some kind of tithing through their system of taxation and you know, all the stuff that goes with it. I mean, we could go on and on about that forever. But and in other words, you don't have any freedom whatsoever at all from the aspect of you have much real control of your life. Oh, yeah, you could be financially independent and you could own six houses, but try not paying the property taxes on those houses and find out who really owns them, right?
That's absolutely right. And it's the limits of a hologram, essentially, are within a certain circumference. And as soon as you start poking your finger through the limits of the hologram, you start to realize only then that there is a limit to the illusion. So what if the illusion was freedom, and as soon as you start poking in the wrong place, you know, it starts to give you a little bit of an electric shock. Get back in the hologram.
That's a great analogy. And, you know, I've had this argument with, you know, people I care about, love, I could say, and I let them be. But, you know, one of my friends in Canada, and I was kind of on this thought process, and he just was arguing with me like, what do you mean? I've got all kinds of freedom. You know, I'm so free, it's unbelievable. I mean, I could get in my car and I could go anywhere. Yeah, well, run a red light and see how free you are, you know? And I could park anywhere I want. Well, try not paying the parking attendant and see how free you are, you know? So he is in this illusion. And I mean, he meant it. I mean, he was full of head and heart. I mean, I'm free. I got to go. I could go down to the airport right now and I could pick up a ticket and I could go to New Zealand tomorrow, if I want to. That's how free I am. Yeah, well, when you go to New Zealand, you know, try spitting on the customs agent and see how free you are. I mean, this is, and that was probably a bad analogy. I'm sorry, I take that back. I didn't mean anything offensive about it. I just thought of something disgusting that would immediately probably end you up in jail. And that's why I used it. So I hope, and see, I'm being politically correct here, Vinny, and I don't mind it. But, you know, even I am brainwashed to a certain level. I've been one of the more free thinkers around, but I'm already conditioned by the system to say, oh, forgive me, Vinny, I didn't mean it. I meant it to make the point, and my point is that if you did something that disgusting, it'd show you that you're not free, that the state owns you, even though you're in a foreign country, and they'd probably whack your butt in jail and extradite you back because you did that.
It's not entirely dissimilar from what Steve Hughes actually noted about political correctness. He says, political correctness is just intellectual colonialism and psychological fascism for the creation of thought crime. All right. And it just basically goes down to we are having our own minds colonized by a foreign ideology that we do not know. And people get a sense of power when they put on a uniform. Uniform, one form, ladies and gentlemen, meaning there is no differentiation in between you. To destroy that individualism is to destroy your individual responsibility. That's called cult indoctrination. If they give you a number, that's cult indoctrination. Officer 1532. You see?
Yeah.
They don't call you by your names. You're not you anymore. You're that that drone, that piece of that device, essentially, a device of the state. And if they can successfully supplant your own personality with a foreign body, essentially, this is what the ancients talked about when they really talked about demon possession, is that possession of a human being is about possession mostly of their ideas. And after a certain period of time, usually with cults, there are certain members who might leave the cult, but when they go back to their families, they're not the same person anymore. They're gone forever, right? They're never going to return. And this is something we're all going to really watch out for. There is no good barrel, okay? It's a bad barrel. And if you're a good apple, don't go in it, all right? You can change more from the outside. And I see a lot of people like this trying to get involved with the system and that kind of thing. And it's just like, no. The people throughout history who have changed anything, really, really changed anything, didn't do it from the political pulpit. All right? It's the people working behind the scenes, the people who are influencing the water that lurks within all mankind and giving it that little whisper and influence in their own little way. Each and every day, that is the wave that washes away the hardest rock.
Very good. Vinny, what do you think is the number one most important thing people can do at this point in history to do for a solution? Let's look at solutions. What do you do a lot to help people. What do you think is the best you know, advice you can give somebody.
Say these two words to yourself. Fuck it.
So what?
So like you get an idea instantly. You've got a responsibility for the idea, and you got to just say fuck it and do it. You know, I feel like writing this book. Oh, but people might judge me. Fuck it. I've got a movie idea or a script that I want to write. Oh, but I may not have enough time for it or anything like. Fuck, do it now. Right. As soon as you can start to obey the instincts within 5 seconds, all your creative instincts right there. You have 5 seconds to react before they're gone forever. That energy. Obey your instincts. All your creative instincts, anything that makes you want to create something or build better or work on something, as soon as you have that inspiration, you must act on it very, very quickly. That's essentially it. Best piece of advice you can really give anybody is follow your own instinctual advice.
Very good. So we talked about water a little bit. Can you tell me more about it? I mean, I think that's an essential thing. Have you had any... I'm sure you have. Tell me about some of the input you've gotten in the comments section after this fellow talked about the distilled water. If you had comments, I started it, I feel better, this is an important, this has been a life changer for me, or anything like that?
Well, when you're not drinking fluoride in your water, the world opens up with all positive possibilities, right? But the thing is, water's kind of like the bridge between dimensions sort of thing. You know, that's why we have holy water and such and blah, blah, blah. That's why we bless food, because all that food is full of water. And essentially what happens is this Japanese scientist dude, keep forgetting his name, was taking these photos of water crystals that had certain words on the outside of the bottle. So he would have hate, anger, and nobody loves me on three bottles, and he would have love, compassion, and everybody loves me on another bottle, right? And he took a photo of the crystals. Now, these beautiful geometric shapes that you see in like snowflakes and things like that, that was what the crystals look like with these nice positive words on it. But these very, very much darker, ugly, bubbly, kind of ragey sort of patterns that had almost no geometry to them whatsoever was what was inside the crystals with the negative words on it. Now, what that means is because we're made out of allegedly up to 70% water or give or take, the numbers on this change or whatever, but we're constantly dehydrated, first of all. Most people are walking around with about 50% hydration. When you eat a corn chip, that's dry. Is it dry when it comes out? No, it's not. Where does that water come from? It comes from you. You're being sucked dry, ladies and gentlemen. We're aging faster. We can't concentrate as much and so on and so forth. Incidentally, makes us easier to control. So if you're starting to drink a lot of water and you're starting to be really positive, it affects the water inside your body and you generate good vibes and you feel better. It's a self-reinforcing feedback loop of positivity, just having good water and good vibes, right? And a lot of people forget that. That's why they're drinking sodas all the time. And I don't know, I love my coffee mostly because it's full of water. Don't have the milk in it. And when I go out places now, I tend to just take my water with me. Like when I go to band practice with the boys, I'm always taking these big 20-litre jugs of proper mineral water that I'm getting from the organic shops and things like that, from an artesian well 600 feet below the surface that gets purified and has all this other stuff. So that's the kind of importance that I have on hydration, because, you know, what are the three most important things in life? Water, food and sleep. Make sure if you're hungry, eat. If you're thirsty, drink. If you're sleepy, sleep. And a lot of people, buddy, stay up late. And, you know, they're like, I'll put on another DVD. No, no, just go to bed. Go to bed. Get up at 4 o'clock in the morning if you have to, bro. That's what I do. I get half a day's work done before anybody else is up in the morning. David Morgan, thank you very much for joining us, and we will see you again sometime at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.